We're taking on a big project here and we need your help.
We are restoring this beautiful, huge house built in 1878 and the 3 acres of land it's on.
We're doing it so that it can be a cooperative, communal space for people to live, work, create, and do activism.
We want to share income and resources and be a place where people can live and thrive no matter how much money they make.
There are many ways that you can help us, but the most mutually beneficial way is to subscribe to Solidarity House on Patreon.
Your subscription supports the effort to restore the house and the land, and it gets you access to tons of bonus material, including full unedited interviews, our original music, and more.
Please subscribe to Solidarity House and help us grow a commune out here.
And remember, you're getting 3 podcasts for the price of 1. Solidarity House, Solidarity Wyoming, and Cowboys on the Commons.
Yeehaw!
We're Solidarity House on Patreon and Solidarity House Cooperative on Facebook and Twitter.
Howdy. Welcome to Solidarity Wyoming, a podcast about politics in Wyoming, brought to you by Solidarity House Cooperative. Today, we'll be hearing from 2 dynamic figures in Wyoming politics. Sabrina King is the policy director of the ACLU of Wyoming, and Eric Mulvar is executive director of Western Watersheds Project. Both Sabrina and Eric will be challenging some firmly held assumptions about Wyoming politics, from the assumption that Wyoming conservatism is a monolith to our foundational mythology that we're the cowboy state, thriving and dependent upon, among other things, the cattle industry. So first, Sabrina King, the policy director of the Wyoming ACLU, visited us here at Solidarity House a couple of weeks ago to talk about the upcoming state legislative agenda, the year-long battle against the construction of an immigration detention facility out in Evanston, and also what it's like advocating for civil liberties in Wyoming. So we cooked her some breakfast, and then we came out to our studio, and we had this conversation.
In terms of legislation, our top priorities are going to be, first off, working on repealing the death penalty here in Wyoming. A bill has been introduced for the past 4 years to facilitate the repeal. But the bill hasn't ever gone anywhere. However, over time, just sort of within the legislature itself, there seems to be a growing group of people who support the repeal.
Bipartisan.
The thing that will get that over the hump is actually having a little bit of a push from the public, because up until now, it has really been just sort of exclusively legislators talking to each other, seeing who wants to be on the bill. But I think to really move it forward, having a group of people who can kind of push that will hopefully help. So death penalty repeal, and then there will be a variety of other proposed criminal justice reform bills, which Wyoming is in a place right now where either the system gets reformed or new beds are going to have to be built, which is not the direction that anyone should be going in right now. So we are hoping that the legislature actually moves on some of those this year so that we can start decreasing the incarceration rates in Wyoming. And then a variety of other things will come up. We have heard that there will be some sort of reiteration of last year's Senate File 74, which was the Crimes Against Critical Infrastructure bill, otherwise known as the anti-protest bill. Mm-hmm. So the fossil fuel industry of Wyoming lost that one badly, and they certainly don't take losses well. So the sense is there will probably be some form of anti-protest legislation. It looks like there might be some kind of comprehensive anti-discrimination law protecting LGBTQ folks in Wyoming.
I just heard about that.
Yeah, but that kind of remains to be seen what exactly that will look like. So mm-hmm. A variety of issues, and then of course responding to whatever else happens to come up. You know, there are 90 people in the legislature and any one of them can propose a bill. So always an open question.
The detention center and where the movement is with that.
The YOSA No campaign is kind of the space in which that movement is being housed right now, I guess. So Immigration and Customs Enforcement constantly pushes to expand their ability to detain immigrants. One of the places that they want to expand is in the Salt Lake City area. They want to build a new private immigration prison somewhere within a radius around Salt Lake City. So, of course, Management and Training Corporation, which is housed in Centerville, which is just north of Salt Lake, went to Uinta County, which is in the southwest corner of Wyoming, and basically handed them a resolution and said, if you guys pass this, we can pursue building a private immigration prison in your county. So Uinta County passed it. The Evanston City Council also passed it. That happened over a year ago now. Mm-hmm. And about a year ago, it'll be a year in October, ICE put out a request for information, basically saying, we want to build around Salt Lake City. All of the private prison companies in the country, tell us what you can give us. So there were four proposed cities. One of them was Salt Lake. As far as we know, you know, the only prison company that is actively pursuing the Evanston site right now is Management and Training Corporation. So all of that happened around-ish a year to a year and a few months ago. When we found out, we immediately started working with Juntos and working with a couple of other groups around the state to basically build out a campaign to stop this from being built. That campaign, the YSNO campaign, launched in January. And since that time, we really have built up a robust movement in Wyoming, not just against this proposed immigration prison, but really building out and connecting with organizations across the country who are fighting detention altogether. Really trying to work to get the profiteering out of the whole system, which is really part of how this is so entrenched, and really fighting to build out a national campaign that would end private immigration detention and immigration detention in, you know, counties and local jails, and just end the whole system that we have built over the course of the past really 30 years of detaining people who are trying to migrate. So the YSANO campaign in Wyoming has really built up around, you know, ideas of keeping family together, which is kind of tapping into the national narrative around what separating families does, but also really talking about the reality of living in a rural state where our communities need everyone, and where, in, you know, in this entire country, but especially in the West, unless you are indigenous, like, you are a migrant from somewhere. So really kind of trying to tap into this idea of, like, we are collective communities that need each other. Mm-hmm. And if we are ripping people out of our communities, if we're ripping them out of our families, we are doing a disservice to all of us.
Working on this project has felt, for me, a sense of invigoration and optimism about maybe the future of the politics in the state.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think one of our goals from the outset was to involve people from around the state and for it to be led by people of color and led by folks in Uinta County. So led by the kind of two directly impacted communities. And along with that, really wanting to reach out to people across the state who have always been kind of doing this work, but who have never necessarily been connected under one banner or one campaign or one movement. So our launch party, out of the chute, we wanted to have people around the state watching that, participating in it, being a part of it. And I think that, for me, has been sort of one of the markers, is that there are people from all over who feel committed to ensuring that this doesn't happen, not from just sort of some philosophical standpoint, but because everyone across the state understands what it means when a company like MTC comes into your county and says, like, hey, we're going to promise you all of these jobs, but we're going to make those jobs be in one of the most terrible industries, but, like, hey, you have nothing else, right? So we think people around the state recognize that, like, constantly we are at the behest of oil companies, coal companies, private prison companies. Everybody's seen it. And everybody also knows that in their town there has been a history of racism. There's been a history of oppression. There's a history of just struggle in this state. And I think in part because of what's happening nationally, people are just invigorated in general to want to do something and to have something that is here to be able to say, like, if we can fight this, we can fight anything. And if we do it collectively, and if we do it under a banner that brings us all together, we can actually potentially, like, make some significant change. The most exciting time in this campaign was actually when we had our final Fiesta Stay Familias in Evanston. And it was clear to me at that point that, like, this happens in every sort of good organizing struggle, right? Where there becomes a moment where it kind of takes on a life of its own. People sort of just start taking ownership and participating and believing in a cause in a way that, like, lifts a little bit of the burden off of the original organizers, right? For so much of the campaign, it was just like, we felt like we just had to be, like, just working tooth and nail to even get this off the ground. it has its own momentum.
And then
now.
Then it picked up its own momentum.
Yeah. Who's the first person in Uinta County who gets up and says, like, actually, I don't want this, even though, like, they're promising jobs? You know, like, it's really difficult. But it's also essential to sort of allow for that space and for communities to develop their own messaging and their own grassroots networks and their own way of going about doing the work. Because, frankly, if we don't, then, like, you know, we're just another group of people coming in and telling people how to live their lives, which is exactly what MTC is doing. You know, like, there's such a simplistic notion that, you know, there's a red state and a blue state, and that means a particular thing. And the reality is, it is so much more complicated here. I mean, yes, the vast majority of the legislature is Republican. The vast majority of people who are in the state are Republican. The vast majority are white. The vast majority are working class. The vast majority are straight and cisgender. There are a lot of other people, a lot of other elements, a lot of other moving pieces that make it a particularly interesting place to do policy work. Part of that is just the very vast, very rural nature of Wyoming that makes it, I think, an interesting place to work despite its sort of overwhelming majority, quote unquote. But also just that within that, there is such a variety of thought and there is such a variety of political philosophy. And I think when you sort of get the pundit map after each presidential election that just sort of says, like, who did they vote for? You miss a lot of nuance and you miss a lot of character and you miss a lot of how people are actually going about their thought process. And because, you know, historically we've put so much weight on, like, who's president because we've given that person so much power, that then sort of reflects back into a state and people say, like, oh, well, you all voted for Donald Trump, so you all feel a particular way. But even that in and of itself reinforces the preeminence of, like, that person, which in my personal opinion should have far less power, like, regardless of who was president. But take that and sort of put it to the side, it's still relevant. But then come into the state and look at state-level politics and look at everything that is happening here, and you could not predict what goes on at the state legislature if you just said, well, like, well, you know, you all voted for Donald Trump, so ergo, you are going to do X. It doesn't work that way.
No.
You know, like, there has been anti-immigrant legislation that's been proposed. It doesn't even get a hearing. Anti-trans legislation doesn't go anywhere here. You know, there are a lot of other ways in which this state does not take what people would assume would be the typical positions simply because the vast majority of people voted for Donald Trump. It just doesn't translate directly. One of the more interesting pieces in the fight against ICE in this immigration prison is last year in the budget session. I mean, the libertarians of the state almost got passed a budget resolution that would have prevented the state from spending any money whatsoever on any kind of private immigration prison. That's not something you would expect to see from, I mean, you wouldn't see it from the Trump administration, obviously. You wouldn't expect to see that in a sort of quote-unquote Trumpian state. But again, it's so much more complicated. And just to follow that through a little bit, it's complicated on the Democrat side too, you know?
Sure. I mean, absolutely.
Mary Throne, who is a historic lobbyist for the fossil fuel industry and has fought tooth and nail against some local communities to promote the interests of the fossil fuel industry. So you have this very strange dynamic of, like, well, Democrat, yes, and also pure Wyoming.
Well, what can we expect to see in the coming weeks and months? You know, what do you want to say about
what comes next?
Talk about your thing.
Well, I think the big thing that we are waiting on right now, especially in terms of the YOC No campaign, is any kind of movement from the federal government and what they want to do. So sometime in the next couple of months, we may or may not hear from ICE about where they actually want to try to expand their capacity to detain people. So that might be Evanston. They might decide that that's not a site that they want to build. We don't know. That said, we still need people to be involved in the campaign, and that's honestly the most active place that we are right now. We're going to be doing a bunch of canvassing over the course of the next 6 to 8 weeks, really trying to work to build up more of a base of people so that if and when ICE does make a decision, we have a massive number of people who can mobilize very quickly. I think we are also really building out what our legislative work is going to look like. And so that's going to be a moving piece over the next few months. And then the final piece is, of course, the election is coming up. So we're working on just kind of making sure that we have the resources in place so that if there are issues at the polls on voting day or if people sort of see suspicious things, that folks know kind of where to go. So if anyone is interested in, you know, a Know Your Rights training or a poll watcher training or anything else like that in the lead up to the election, definitely get in touch with us, because that's something that we're really going to be watching for over the course of the next few months and in the lead up to November. So that's kind of what all of that looks like, moving pieces as always. You know, and then once we hit the legislative session, I will be primarily focused there, but Antonio Serrano, who's our organizer, will just continue plunking away in the YSNO campaign. And, you know, Courtney and other folks who are in Uinta County continue to do the same, and all of those pieces will keep moving until we win.
That's great. And finally, you're an outdoors person. So what are some of your favorite spots in Wyoming?
Oh my God, everywhere. I mean, one of the joys of working here is that I go and have meetings with folks in Cody or Lander or Jackson or Uinta County or Casper or anywhere, and I just sort of camp that evening. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite places, and I'm going to say this one because I think, you know, Casper gets poo-pooed a lot, but if you go just west of Casper out to the Platte River, there are several spots along the Platte where you can camp for a night, and it's, you know, it's BLM, public land, you can camp for free. And it's absolutely gorgeous. I mean, everything that is west of Casper, you know, if you're kind of heading out as if you were going to Rollins, that little spot in between there is a really sort of underappreciated gem, other than to people who maybe live around in that area or who have traveled through there. Pretty much anywhere you go, as long as you're not right next to an oil rig, which, granted, that's a lot of the state, but, you know, you can find spots.
Eric Mulvar visited our studios here at Solidarity House in Laramie just yesterday. He's a scientist and the executive director of Western Watersheds Project. He's also a contributing writer at The Hill, which is a national political website. We wanted to talk to Eric about the ecological impact of the cattle industry and how the mythology of the cattle industry affects Wyoming politics and culture.
Well, Western Watersheds Project is an environmental conservation organization that's just going into its 25th anniversary year. And we protect wildlife and watersheds throughout public lands across the West. And we specialize in livestock raising as an issue. And interestingly, Western Watersheds Project was born in 1973 at a moment when the broader environmental community was really aggressively engaging the problem of livestock grazing and all the environmental problems it was causing across public lands in the West. Interestingly, over the years that followed, there was a political backlash to that. And I think that the livestock industry was very effective at rallying political support and, you know, kind of media and social support behind its cause to brand itself as, you know, kind of you know, at the center of Western custom and culture. And a lot of environmental groups gave up on trying to fix the problem because it was just too much of a political hot potato. Meanwhile, Western Watersheds Project grew into that void and became the leading voice for folks who want to address the problem of public lands, livestock grazing. And interestingly, our supporters run the gamut of a really diverse group of people. You know, we have folks that are supporting us because they're hunters and they recognize that livestock are taking all the forage and they can't find as many elk or deer. We have people that are animal rights supporters who support us because we are trying to interdict the livestock industry's efforts to kill off native wildlife they find inconvenient to their profit motives. We have folks that are recreationists that just want to go out and enjoy the public lands and don't want to wade through a sea of cow pies. There are a great deal of different demographics of people that are really concerned about this major environmental problem, and we're kind of the only ones that are really out there addressing it.
And you're addressing it primarily through legal strategies. Is that would it be accurate to say that, you know, that is more or less your starting point strategically and tactically?
I think certainly, you know, the judicial system and federal laws and making sure that federal laws that protect the environment are being upheld are central to our efforts. We don't do a great deal of grassroots organizing. Some do. We do a little bit of work on policy and politics in D.C. We're really focused on enforcing federal laws. There's a big trend right now that's being pushed by the ag industry and the minerals industry and their allies in places like public lands land-grant universities to, you know, let's all just sit around a table and collaborate. And if we all just got together and talked it all out, we would come to some agreement. We would find some area of overlapping interest. The difficulty in public lands conservation issues is that the overlapping area of interest between, say, the livestock industry and the oil and gas industry and the general public is so tiny that the things you can achieve in that space are trivial and insignificant and don't address any of the real issues.
That a bedrock industry is premised on something that is just going to be inevitably destructive to the environment here. That just feels like a big deal when you really start to absorb it in the context of our culture and history. So how do you feel about that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a disconnect between reality and the myths that we create for ourselves, especially those myths about our identity in the West and how it's tied to the livestock industry and how the American cowboy really is emblematic of Western custom and culture in some way. And interestingly, before there were any cattle in the American West, obviously, this land was populated by indigenous peoples who were living in harmony with the land in a, you know, in a subsistence economy of hunting and gathering that was fully compatible with all the native wildlife that were here, which were abundant mm-hmm. at that time. Interestingly, John Wesley Powell, one of the earliest explorers, came out west and he wrote in his journals that basically everything west of the 100th meridian, which goes through the middle of Nebraska, is really the Great American Desert and is really unsuitable for agriculture of any kind. And he was right. And everybody, every booster that came after that said that rain would follow the plow and that you could really make a lot of money with agriculture in the West, and this was really a breadbasket for the world, has been lying to us all and to themselves. And the reality is that, you know, this is a desert. The Great Plains are a desert. The Intermountain West is a desert. These are marginal agricultural lands. Interestingly, if you look at the Western public lands, which are fairly vast, and, you know, maybe, you know, a significant proportion of our Western states, there are 1.9% of the cattle in the United States that ever set a hoof on Western public lands. Nobody calls Ohio the cowboy state, but there are far more cattle in Ohio than there are in Wyoming. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that you have so much more rainfall, that you can have so much more cattle, so many more cattle per acre in a fertile place with deep soils that has abundant rainfall than you can out in a desert with thin soils that are unproductive. That basically this is a marginal kind of economy. And interestingly, when the very first cattle drives came in the West, there was this idea of the open range and this mythology that grew up that was really seized upon by Hollywood and glorified, the idea of the independent American rancher. But really, what happened as the first cattle drives became the first ranches was that you had the second and third sons of British nobility coming in with stacks of money to establish large ranches and control as much of the range as they could. And by having really big economies of scale, they could make it work. But if you were trying to be a smallholder and make an operation out of, you know, a few hundred cattle,
not here.
Really economically marginal. And that's the reality that the family ranchers of today are starting to finally, you know, those chickens are coming home to roost. Because what the children of these ranching families are looking at as they grow up is mom and dad are working very hard and they're working second and third jobs to support their ranching habit because they can't make enough money ranching to support their family. And in the drought years, you're losing money. It turns out that ranching makes up, and agriculture as a whole, including farming, makes up 1.5% of the gross domestic product of the state of Wyoming. The ecological cost of trying to force this unworkable system to be profitable involve things like overgrazing the heck out of the land and damaging its long-term productivity. It involves trashing stream sides that destroy trout populations. It involves compacting soils, and you know, so that you're not going to have the same even amount of grass for your own cattle the next year. Mm-hmm. Just to run faster to stay even, and to survive as a business operation. And you know, one of the real questions is, if you have such an economically dubious and crippled business model, should you even be doing that on federal land and putting those public assets and those public lands, which are supposed to be for multiple use, into that meat grinder and destroying all of those other resources just so this one ranching operation can struggle to stay even? Cattle are ecologically incompatible with desert systems. Cattle evolved in the boggy meadows of northern Europe. They're really fit to be in places where there's a lot of rainfall, a lot of vegetation productivity. So when you put them out on arid western landscapes, they concentrate all of their activity very close to water. And interestingly, in the arid west, those stream sides and those springs and lakes and ponds are the hot spots for biodiversity for every other native species. So you're mowing down the most ecologically productive areas, and you're destroying the stream systems, either directly by the cattle trampling the banks, overgrazing the vegetation, and causing the erosion and degrading the actual stream channels, but also indirectly, because if you think about it, in the arid west, if you think about the agriculture that is, you know, the plow and plant agriculture, most of it is hay fields, because most of the West doesn't have any winter range for cattle. And so the most fertile bottomlands, the most fertile habitats that were bottomlands, became privatized. And those are now irrigated to produce hay so you can have the cattle over the winter time. And by withdrawing all the water from the rivers and putting it on these hay fields, and then converting these fertile bottomland habitats into hay fields, which are an ecological monoculture and support very little wildlife, that's a whole secondary problem mm-hmm. that the livestock industry brings to the West. You know, I mean, if you're a cattle rancher, you're looking at the public lands through a lens of your own profit margins and your own bottom line, and you would like to maximize that. And in many cases, you'll have these cattle ranchers that are demanding all kinds of ecologically destructive things, everything from fundamentally changing the native vegetation to even planting non-native forage crops like Siberian wheatgrass and crested wheatgrass, which have no wildlife habitat value at all, but are good forage for cattle. Burning sagebrush because they think they're going to have more grass to feed their cows. So all kinds of things that they would like to do to change and alter the landscape. And ultimately, you know, I think if they could wave their magic wand, they would basically domesticate all of the federal public lands and landscape them in the way that maximizes forage for cattle. Mm-hmm. And you know, I don't think they necessarily, you know, want to destroy all the native wildlife in all cases, but they sure don't mind if they do. There's a lot of common knowledge out here in Wyoming about reality that actually is not reality. And there has been a conscious and perhaps unconscious effort by the livestock industry and its allies to reframe the facts of the debate around public lands ranching in ways that are favorable to them and maybe unfavorable to those who would like to have more ecologically sustainable livestock grazing. Most people in Wyoming use and treasure their public lands. They're out there camping, they're out there hunting, they're out there fishing, they're out there bird watching or viewing wildlife. They love these lands, and they love the fact that there's actual land where you can go, and there's not a gate that says no trespassing that's locked against you. There's a general sense that the various Bundy insurrections that have happened around the West are isolated incidents, but really, Clive and Bundy is only a slightly more, you know, obstreperous version of the general philosophy that's in the ranching industry as a whole. And they've got a magazine, a propaganda magazine called Range Magazine, that I found on the desk of Senator Enzi the last time I was in Washington, that promotes this whole land seizure agenda. We do have a rancher in Wyoming, in the Southern Bighorn Basin, who locked his gates against the Bureau of Land Management, preventing the land managers from accessing the public lands to manage them, illegally grazed his cattle on a permit that had been pulled by the BLM for violations of various federal regulations. And that was a standoff that lasted 15 years.
So how can we help you stay in court?
People say, bring lawyers, guns, and money. We don't do the guns. But if you want to make a donation to Western Watersheds Project, you can go to westernwatersheds.org and make that donation and help fund our legal battles. And, you know, stay active, pay attention, look at the science, look at the, you know, the things that your political leaders are saying, and try to get political leaders that really care about public lands and really care about having a healthy environment, regardless of where you live, whether it's in Wyoming or Indiana or Washington State. It matters everywhere.
So you've been listening to Solidarity Wyoming. You can hear full versions of these interviews. They're both much longer than what you heard here. And you can hear those full versions by supporting us on Patreon. And you can help us continue to bring you fascinating interviews with the leaders who swim against the tide here in Wyoming. We're Solidarity House on Patreon. And you can get all of our premium content and be an active supporter for just $5 a month. Thanks. Take care.